Less.com.
Good morning. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Hope you're having a terrific Thursday. I'm Ted Chen from NBC4, the Channel 4 News, sitting in for Larry Mantle. A federal appeals court strengthened privacy rights Wednesday for workers who send text messages from devices supplied by their employer, ruling that the companies transmitting those messages cannot disclose their contents without the recipient's consent or a warrant. This ruling came from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco, which said that a wireless company, in this case Arch Wireless, violated a Ontario police officer's rights by revealing the messages he sent to coworkers, one of whom was his wife, some of the messages sexually explicit. And the court also ruled that the police department where the officer worked also violated his rights by reading those messages. We'd like to hear from you on this matter, from employees. If you have concerns about your emails or text messages being read, this ruling also applies to emails that are taken care of by an outside server. We'd like to hear from you. Our phone number is 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. We'd also especially like to hear from employers and why you may believe that it's important for employers to monitor an employee's emails or text messaging. Joining us to talk about this, Oren Kerr, a professor of law at George Washington University. Professor Kerr, thanks for joining us on Air Talk.
It's a pleasure to be here.
First of all, your reaction to this ruling, how big of a deal is it?
It's a medium deal. There are parts of it that are very important. There are parts of it that are pretty narrow. The biggest part, the most important part, is the court's holding that people have a Fourth Amendment protection, a reasonable expectation of privacy in their text messages, and by extension, the court seems to reason, their emails. So if you're worried about, say, the government getting access to your email, government getting access to your text messages, this is the first Court of Appeals to hold, based on current law, that there is a Fourth Amendment reasonable expectation of privacy. That's a very important holding. The part that isn't as important says that your employer has can't access your private messages. And the catch to that is that if they get your consent, if they have a clean policy that says you have no privacy, then they can. So really that boils down to notice to the employee. It's not quite as broad as some people are maybe making it out to be.
How big of an issue was this in the courts? I mean, how many lawsuits are we seeing on this particular matter on emails and text messaging?
Well, the question of how the Fourth Amendment, which is the constitutional prohibition on unreasonable government searches and seizures, the question of how that applies to email text messages is an incredibly important question. And one earlier Court of Appeals in Ohio reached a decision saying that there was Fourth Amendment protection. However, it was reheard, it was vacated, wiped off the books, pending rehearing. So this is the first court decision to squarely hold that there's Fourth Amendment protection in these sorts of contents. I don't think this opinion is going to be reheard or vacated or anything like that. So this is a case that's around to stay, and it's a very important result for privacy.
In this particular case, the Ontario Police Department warned this officer and all of the officers that their text messaging and their email would be monitored, yet the court still ruled against the department. Explain the process behind that.
Yeah, the question there boils down to how clear the notice was. So a lot of employees, we've all had this experience where there's an employee manual that says, you know, you have no privacy rights at all. And then you ask your boss, hey, are you going to look at this private stuff? And the boss says, no, we're actually not going to look at it. Don't, whatever the privacy says, we're actually not going to look at it. And what the court says in this particular case is, well, the privacy policy said one thing, the practice and what the boss said was another, and we think what the boss said governs. So what an employer would need to do to be able to access the employee's employer-provided messages would be to not send those mixed messages, really.
Let's break it down and separate text messaging from email, because most emails are on an internal server and that the company controls. However, most text messaging is done by an outside server. In this case, it was Arch Wireless. So why is that differentiation important?
Well, it's important to recognize that this is a case involving a government employer and government employee. So this is a case involving a police officer who's given the text messaging device from the government, from the city. And that creates a host of different issues that you wouldn't see if your employer is, say, you know, Comcast, or your employer is General Motors, or your employer is some sort of private sector employer. They're not governed by the Fourth Amendment, the government prohibition on searches and seizures. And in that case, there are pre-existing laws, which this court does touch on, which basically say the employer needs to give notice. So that's why those privacy policies matter a lot. That's why when you first day on the job, a lot of people get something they have to sign that says, I understand I don't have any privacy protection in my work-provided email. And the distinction there that has to be kept in mind is if your employer says you have no privacy protection on your work-provided email, that means you can use your private email. They're not going to be monitoring that.
So are you saying that you have less privacy protection if you work for a private employer?
You have a different set of privacy protections. So if you work for the government, you get Fourth Amendment protections, but those Fourth Amendment protections are kind of modest. The government doesn't need to get a warrant, for example, in every case. If you work for the Postal Service and your boss needs to come to your office, they don't need to get a warrant to enter into your office. So there are modest Fourth Amendment protections, and what this court opinion did is have some parts that are about government employment specifically and some points that are about general privacy protection for text messages, and also the court discusses by implication email. So there's a little bit in here for everyone.
But doesn't the Fourth Amendment also apply to private employers?
It does not. It does not. The Fourth Amendment only applies to the government or private employers acting at the request of the government, the idea being they're sort of agents of the government. So if you have a private employer, you don't have any Fourth Amendment protections against them. They can look through your emails without raising constitutional questions, and whether they raise other legal issues really depends on whether they've given you notice as an employee.
Our phone number, once again, 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. We'd like to hear from employees. And if you have concerns or have had experiences with your employer looking at your email or text messaging or having requested to look at that, we'd also especially like to hear from employers if you believe that it is important to have the right to look at your employees' email or text messages if they use company equipment. Our phone number, once again, 866-893-5722. We also called the Ontario Police Department, which is the focus of this particular ruling. Their attorney did not respond to our inquiry. And we also want to ask our listeners when they do call in if they are aware of what their company's policy is as it pertains to emails or text messaging sent on company property. Let's go to Rachel in Silver Lake. Rachel, good morning. Welcome to Air Talk.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. I actually had a question. If your company provides a cell phone, does that make you lose any of your rights in any way as far as if they wanted to go through your text messages with a company cell phone?
Professor Kerr, you want to tackle that?
The key question here would be notice. If your employer has given you notice that you are waiving any privacy rights, then you don't have any privacy rights. So what you'd look for is when you go into work, is there some form you have to fill, or is there some company policy that says you have no privacy rights? If there's no policy, you would retain your privacy rights. However, it's very important to ask your employer whether there is a privacy policy, because a lot of times, say your first day on the job, you're not paying attention to what exactly what the phrasing is of all these policies and the manuals that they hand you. So ask around, but the key idea here is that you have privacy protection unless you've given it up. But you may have given it up and not known you've given it up.
But Professor Kerr, in this particular case, the employer, in this case the Ontario Police Department, did say that it had the right to monitor those phone calls, those text messaging and the emails, and yet the court ruled against it.
Yeah, in this particular case, there was the company policy that pointed in one direction. What the employer had said was pointed in the other direction. That part of the ruling, I think you shouldn't look too closely at because it was very specific to the facts of that case. The broad principle here is that, generally speaking, if an employer says, we can monitor you, they can. And yes, there may be a different result if they write, put one thing in writing and say another thing. But if you're an employee, I wouldn't rely on that. I would be much more cautious and say that if there is this written policy, assume the employer can do this monitoring.
866-893-5722 is our number, 866-893-KPCC. Let's go to Sandra in West L.A. Sandra, good morning.
Morning. Here's the question. If you work for a public, public agency, and you have your employer assigned email address, but you also have a private email address, a Gmail address, or a Yahoo address, and you access that at work, it goes through their servers. Does that count as well? And I'm going to take my answer off the air, okay?
Professor Kerr, you indicated earlier that private email is protected even if it's accessed on company equipment?
Well, this is a great question. So if you are accessing your private email from a government workplace account, and you've given up privacy in anything that comes onto the government network, by virtue of watching your emails, of downloading your emails onto the government network, you lose privacy protection in anything that you've downloaded. So what that means is that if you want to maintain your privacy in your private accounts, don't look at them from your work accounts, or say if you're a government employee, your government accounts. You'll retain any privacy in your private accounts that you haven't looked at through your government accounts. So you don't, for example, suddenly lose your privacy protection in anything in your privately owned account. But it's absolutely right that once you're in a government workplace, if you start looking at things on that network, on the government's network, and they have said we can watch what's on the network, by bringing it into the government network, you don't have privacy in that, so be careful about that.
So you can't open the email on the government network. You can see what emails you have, but if you open it...
If you want to maintain privacy in a private account, let's say you've got a Gmail account or a Yahoo account or something like that.
You have to open it on a private computer.
You look at it on a private computer. Don't look at it from your government work, because the government can see what you're accessing, what you're viewing, websites you're visiting, anything like that, from a government account. All they have to do is give you notice.
The city of Ontario says it will likely appeal this ruling. Where do you see this going?
Well, the only place to appeal at that point, there are sort of two ways the court could try to appeal it. They could try to get it rehearing en banc. What that means is the entire Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. I think the chances of that are pretty low. And the other alternative is the U.S. Supreme Court. And again, I think the chances of that are pretty low. So they could try appealing it. I don't think it's very likely. In fact, I think it's very unlikely that they'll have any luck doing so.
Okay, once again, our phone number, 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. We're discussing with the professor of law at George Washington University, big difference, Professor Oren Kerr, on the Federal Appeals Court ruling that employers cannot open and read text messaging and certain emails without the consent of the employee. If you have a concern about this as an employee or especially as an employer and have an interest in it, please give us a call. We'd like to hear from you. 866-893-5722. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Ted Chen from NBC4, filling in for Larry Mantle. Back in a moment.
Programming is supported by the New Fidelity Investor Center in Thousand Oaks on South Westlake Boulevard. You can learn more at 1-800-FIDELITY. Fidelity Brokerage Services member, NYSE SIPC.
If it's time to get rid of that old gas guzzler, KPCC can help. When you donate your used car, truck, or boat to KPCC, you're also supporting the news you trust. And you know, you'll get great mileage out of your listening, too. Donate your vehicle today at kpcc.org. And thanks.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by Next Book, presenting Jewish Geography on Sunday, June 29th, a festival of ideas exploring place, design, memory, and imagination, featuring architects, writers, activists, and artists, including Julia Shulman, Shalom Auslander, Daphne Merkin, Andy Lipkis, Mia Lehrer, and Peter Eisenman. The day begins with a free family festival, and all events take place at UCLA's McGowan Hall. For tickets, call 310-825-2101 or click on nextbook.org. Governor Schwarzenegger is speaking out against President Bush's suggestion to end the federal ban on offshore oil drilling. In a statement, Schwarzenegger says new fuel choices would serve consumers better. Jean Fuller, a Republican assemblywoman from oil-rich Kern County, says the supply problem has less to do with drilling than with government oversight.
And one of our obstacles at this time is that refining and distribution, which is also crucial to oil exploration, is very hampered by costly regulations that make it very difficult for us to expand the supply at a cheaper rate.
Democratic Assembly Speaker Karen Bass dismissed offshore oil drilling as an absurd idea that disregards environmental concerns. Well, it's going to be a hot one again in the Southland today. Temperatures above the century mark for the next few days, as a matter of fact, cooling off just a wee bit on Sunday. It's 10:21.
This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, online at kpcc.org. I'm Ted Chen from NBC4, the Channel 4 News, sitting in for Larry Mantle. We continue our discussion of a federal appeals court ruling that limits the ability of employers to obtain emails and text messaging sent by employees on company accounts, in particular on company devices. Access to email would be barred if the employer contracts out its email service rather than maintaining an internal server. Most companies keep employee email on their servers. However, most companies contract out text messaging. And we are discussing this with Professor Orrin Kerr with George Washington University. He is a professor of law, and we welcome your phone calls, 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. Professor Kerr, first, I want to clarify with you on the text messaging part. My understanding is that if it's handled by an outside vendor now, a company cannot access that text messaging, even if it tries to do in advance warning of it. Is that correct?
Well, the difference with text messaging, the difference between emails and text messaging, is that typically the employer is not going to have their own internal text messaging. But in this particular case, it was conceded that the employer was the subscriber of the email, or of the text messages, rather. So the question here is what are the rules that govern access to those, to the outside server? And the basic idea is that the employer needs consent. So in it actually doesn't make that much of a difference if it's outsourced providing or insourced, rather, you know, if it's the company that's running the provider, or if they've hired somebody else to do it, because the employer can always get the employee's consent. They can always get the okay of the employee. And the question here is really, what are the rules when the okay, the permission, is unclear? And in this particular case, the court says, you didn't give clear enough notice to the employee.
So without the consent, the employer cannot arbitrarily look at text messaging.
That's absolutely right.
All right, thank you so much. Let's go to our phone calls and go to Dan in Santa Monica. Dan, good morning.
Good morning. I had a question. I heard your guest say a few minutes ago that you have all your rights that the law normally affords you unless you engage in employment where you've been told you're supposed to lay this policy to the otherwise. And I wondered if you begin the job where you have all your normal privacy rights retained, and then after you've on the job, the employer wants to change the rules, do they have complete control over what rule they change to? Is there any notice that has to be given, or a period of time that has to be given in order for those rules to go into effect?
Good question, Dan. Professor Kerr?
The law talks about notice being the key. So as long as the employer tells you that they're having a change in policy, they're allowed to do that. They can change the policy really to whatever they want it to be. Now, that's at least the privacy law here. There may be other areas of law that limit the employer's ability to do that. So, for example, in a unionized work environment, it may be part of the union contract that the employer is not allowed to do that, or that there needs to be some special rules when privacy policies are changed. But if you're not in a unionized work environment, the employer just has to say, hey, here's the new rule. And we've got what's called employment at will in most states, and the basic idea is that if you don't like working there, you can leave, and so you have to take that as a condition of employment. So the employer generally does have the authority to change the privacy policies, and most employers, I mean, this is sort of the general rule, most employers will say, we retain the right to look at this information for an employer-provided service. It's ours, they're thinking. If we need to look at it, we should be allowed to look at it without being sued, for example, for doing so. But the employer does retain the right to change the policy.
And this ruling, by and large, protects that.
Yes, it does.
All right, let's go to David in Los Angeles. David, welcome to Air Talk.
Yes, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. Like I said, I am the Director of Information Services for a reasonably large company here in L.A., and this has brought up some really interesting questions. First, sort of building on the previous caller, if we implement a new security policy today and everyone agrees to it, does that give us the right retroactively to look at messages that may have been sent or received previous to us giving notice? That's my first question. My second question is this. If we have our email hosted in-house, so we are in control of it, and therefore our employees have no expectation of privacy, but do the people sending email to them on our network have an expectation of privacy?
Wow, both really good questions, David. Let's ask Professor Kirk question one. Can a policy be retroactive?
We don't know, actually. This is a fantastic question. This is the kind of questions law professors like me like to think about. We actually don't know whether an employer can do that. I suspect that they can. The reason being that once you're looking at stored emails, there's a different set of laws that apply, actually, than apply to getting sort of real-time emails. So in all likelihood, they can, although the legal reason ends up being a little bit complicated. And I'm completely blanking on the second question.
Question number two was about the sender of the email. Do I have a reasonable expectation of privacy if I send an email to someone's work address or work text address? Don't I have some privacy there, or can the company that I'm sending it to read my email to that person?
Got it. Once you've sent your email and once it has arrived at the destination, once it's arrived at the recipient, you no longer have privacy protection in it. So it's actually very similar to a letter. Let's say I send you a letter. I have privacy protection against, say, the government accessing my letter while it's being sent.
But if you send it to my workplace,
it becomes your letter.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I interrupt you.
And so basically, the takeaway from this is once you've sent an email and once it's been received, you don't have privacy protection in it. So it's the privacy protection of the recipient that governs.
So in your letter, you're saying that if I send a letter to my friend at his work address, the company has a right to look at it?
It certainly doesn't violate your rights as the sender.
I see. Thank you. Let's go to April in Burbank. April, good morning.
Morning. I guess mine is more of a comment about if I owned a company car and I was putting a whole bunch of extra miles on it personally, I would think my employer would want to know where I was driving that car. So I'm wondering why people assume that they can use a personal email address or a business email address or a business cell phone for so much personal use.
Thank you, April. That's an interesting question, Professor Kerr. I mean, is there any reasonable expectation of privacy in a work environment when you're using work equipment?
You know, it depends on what you think email or text messages really mean. And here's what's tricky, I think. So we're all very familiar with the notion of an employer-provided car, an employer-provided office. But what's the real analogy for employer-provided email or text messages? When an employer gives you an account, an employer gives you a BlackBerry, is that like a little bit of work coming to you, or is that like your employer giving you a little piece of private property that's yours? Different people are going to have different answers to that, and what these lawsuits are really about is what's the default answer? Does the employer automatically have rights to it, or do they have to get permission to access the information? And what this court said is, at least in the case of text messages given to a different provider, they need to get permission first.
Perhaps one could argue, and I'll make this the last question, that even though this is a tool to improve the quality of your work provided by your employer, that everybody at one time or another would make phone calls or a text message to family that are work-related, or could be work-related, that is in connection or to further the work, and that there might be some expectation of privacy there when you have areas overlapping of work and private life. Is there a point there?
Yes. The difficulty is the law needs to come up with some sort of rule that employers can follow to know when they can monitor and when they can't.
Okay.
It's hard to come up with a sort of nuanced line, sometimes yes, sometimes no. So what we're really looking for is bright line rules. So the employers know, yes, they can do this, no, they can't. They're not worried about facing a lawsuit. And employees have a clear idea of when they can be sure they have privacy and when they can't be sure. So you're right that some of these lines can be furry, blurry in practice, but as a practical matter, the law is looking for some bright line rules.
Okay, thank you so much. Oren Kerr, professor of law at Georgetown. Kept doing it. George Washington University. I don't know why I keep wanting to say Georgetown. Back in a minute with our Inland Empire Journalist Roundtable. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Happy Thursday. I'm Ted Chen from KNBC, the Channel 4 News, sitting in for Larry Mantle. This half hour, we will conduct our Inland Empire Journalists Roundtable. A lot of news happening in the Inland Empire. And our first story that we'll discuss is the ongoing situation and controversy involving the shooting of three people, the fatal shooting of three people at the Saboba Indian Reservation in Riverside County by Riverside County Sheriff's deputies. The Saboba Band operates a casino and outdoor concert on a 3,100-acre reservation in the foothills of the San Jacinto Mountains, and the deputies union has for a while publicly discouraged people from patronizing that casino because of the possible dangers and gunplay there, which has increased tensions with the tribe. But there could be a possible deal in the works. And joining us to discuss this and other news in the Inland Empire, Stephen Cuevas, KPCC's Inland Empire Bureau reporter. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Ted.
And also Cassie McDuff, columnist with the Press Enterprise. Cassie, thanks for coming on.
Good to be with you.
Stephen, let's start with you on the reservation case. What's the latest?
Well, the latest is right now authorities, meaning the Sheriff's Department from Riverside County, some county leaders, Bureau of Indian Affairs, and other agencies have been basically in close talks with tribal leaders at Saboba to work out some sort of agreement over how policing should be should be managed on the reservation. The tribe has some tribal security. They're unarmed. They mainly handle the casino area, the entertainment area. And Riverside County Sheriff's Department responds to more serious things when they flare up. Right now, in the wake of the shooting, they're only responding to 911 emergencies and only responding when they have backup. So right now, basically, they're trying to work out some sort of agreement over how this policing should be done, because there's been so much tensions since these shootings. You know, one side alleging one thing, the tribal elders alleging something else. It's just been, you know, kind of an escalation, a war of words in the months since the last shooting.
We also want to mention David Kelly from the Los Angeles Times is joining us on our Inland Empire Journalist Roundtable. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to go to Cassie, though, next on this issue at the reservation. Your perspective.
Well, Ted, it's a really sad situation. Three people have lost their lives. It seemed to begin with a car chase in December. CHP pursued a vehicle off the I-10 freeway onto the reservation, and there was an exchange of gunfire. That was last December, and at the end of the month, there was another situation where sheriff's deputies shot and killed a reservation resident, and from there, it's just escalated, and the sheriff's department is saying that there's a lawless element on the reservation. Reservation saying, you know, they want to be the ones to assert control over that sort of rogue element and get the situation under control. They feel the sheriff's department's tactics have been heavy-handed. bringing what they call the 7th Cavalry onto the reservation whenever there's an incident. And, you know, this has caused a lot of ill feeling, and that's what the subject of the closed-door talks are. U.S. Department of Justice mediators are there, as Stephen mentioned, Bureau of Indian Affairs, trying to get the Sheriff's Department and the tribal leadership to sit down and talk about how this situation can be brought in hand.
David, can you expand further on this issue, this complicated issue of sovereignty and jurisdiction, when you have a federal, county, and the reservation authorities themselves all involved in this? Who's responsible for what?
Well, excuse me, that's the heart of it. It depends on who you speak to. Robert Salgado, who's the chairman, doesn't believe the sheriff has any business whatsoever patrolling any road that's not a county road, and that would be the main road going in and out of the reservation. The sheriff's deputies say they have every right under Public Law 280, which is applicable to California, to patrol Indian reservations and enforce criminal law on Indian reservations. It's interesting, in other parts of Riverside County, the sheriffs have had deals with tribes to either not patrol them or only respond to 911 calls. On the Saboba Reservation, they've done patrols and responded. So they've been a little more aggressive, but at the same time, there's been a lot of, they've seized guns up to 20 or 30 at a time. They've seized drugs. They've been shot at. They've said they've been shot at. And they've also arrested people who are very close, who are members, who are family members of the top tribal leadership. And that is what a lot of folks say is the heart of the resentment from the Saboba against the sheriff's deputies. A lot of their family members have been targeted and arrested.
So, Stephen, what's the possible compromise here that you may be hearing?
I have no idea. I mean, we've, you know, as David can tell you, we've gone to some of these. We went to the first meeting with the impression that reporters would be told what was going on. And I think David was one of the reporters that was supposed to go in and stay during that meeting. And then he was kicked out. And we don't know. I mean, they gave us basically a one or two sentence statement after that. And they have agreed to not talk to the press about these talks, though, you know, some information has leaked out, and at least one county supervisor has you know, kind of mouthed off a little bit and asked for a shakeup of the tribal council. Otherwise, nothing's ever going to change there. You know, and that kind of stuff doesn't really help. But in terms of what sort of compromise, I really don't know. We could just sort of go back to the way things were. I just don't know, because we don't really know what's on the table. You know, what are the main points of discussion?
Cassie, got about 30 seconds. What's been the business impact on the casino?
Well, the Sheriff's Union recommended that its members not patronize the casino, citing the danger, and have actually, in that same notice, told the public maybe it's not a good idea to go there right now. The tribe says it's not worried. Gamblers are gamblers, and they're going to continue patronizing the casino.
Has that really hurt business, the sheriff's warning?
Hard to gauge. I think those are pretty closely guarded figures in terms of attendance and revenue.
Back with Stephen Cuevas, Cassie McDuff, and David Kelly, our Inland Empire Journalist Roundtable on the issues and stories of the day in the Inland Empire. Coming up, we'll talk about the torture polygamy case, a self-described polygamist in Riverside County convicted last week of torturing and abusing his wives and children.
Programming is supported by the California Association of Professional Scientists, representing 3,000 state scientists protecting public health, the environment, and California's natural resources. Information at calscientist.org.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by Pasadena Water and Power. Landscape professionals advise that most people overwater their lawns by 50%. Overwatering weakens the root system and wastes water. If everyone in Southern California cuts outdoor watering one day per week, we could save 73 billion gallons of water per year. You can save water by irrigating only two times per week. For more information, you can go to PasadenaSavesWater.com.
This is 89.3 KPCC, traffic and weather at kpcc.org. Closing arguments will resume today in the trial of the man accused of causing a Metrolink derailment that killed 11 people and injured more than 180. Yesterday, the prosecution claimed Juan Alvarez was making a statement and never intended to commit suicide. They are seeking the death penalty.
Tom Lantos, the late San Mateo and San Francisco representative, is one of six to receive the Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian award. Lantos, a Hungarian-born Jew who was the only Holocaust survivor to serve in Congress, he was widely known as a human rights champion. President Bush presented the Medal of Freedom this morning at the White House.
The award recognizes outstanding individuals who have been leaders in their chosen fields, have led lives of vision and character, and have made especially meritorious contributions to our nation and the world.
Other recipients include a retired Marine Corps officer, two doctors, a former Secretary of Health and Human Services under President Bill Clinton, and a retired federal appeals court judge. Taking a look at traffic in Glendale right now, the 5 South, very slow from Colorado to the 2. It's 10:41.
This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, election coverage on air and online at kpcc.org. I'm Ted Chen from NBC4, the Channel 4 News, sitting in for Larry Mantle. We continue our Inland Empire Journalist Roundtable with Stephen Cuevas, KPCC's Inland Empire reporter, Cassie McDuff, columnist with the Press Enterprise, and David Kelly, staff writer for the LA Times. We move on to a truly horrifying case. A self-described polygamist from Riverside County convicted last week of torturing and abusing his wives and more than a dozen children and stepchildren. A jury convicted Mansa Mohammed 24 counts of torture and false imprisonment. Children and wives describe horrifying incidents of imprisonment, starvation, rape, and beatings. The abuse occurred at the family's ranch in Aguanga, a rural area about 20 miles east of Temecula, near the San Diego County border. Cassie, what's one of the things that's amazing about this is Mr. Mohammed blamed his wives for all of this.
Well, the whole case came to light, and this is astonishing. It took 9 years to come to trial. It came to light in 1999 when one of the wives passed a letter describing this abuse and maltreatment of the women and children to a postal clerk, and it found its way to law enforcement authorities who went in and interviewed the wives and children who say they were virtually held captive, were subjected to beatings, deprived of food as a punishment, made to stand for hours as punishment. And ultimately, he was charged with torture and abuse and false imprisonment and convicted after a 5-week trial. It took the jury just 3 hours to reach that verdict. And as you say, he blamed his wife, who one of the wives was also accused of some of this abuse. And she was not ultimately convicted, or even, I don't believe she even went to trial. But throughout, he did take the stand, and throughout he has blamed his children, said they all concocted the tale, and blamed the wife, said the children were just trying to protect her by blaming him. Obviously, the jury felt that was pretty far-fetched. A doctor who examined the children said that some of them were so malnourished they were half the size of what their age they should have been.
And did he have an explanation for that?
He just said it's a small-statured family.
Stephen, why did this case take so long to get to trial?
Good question. You know, I did not follow the trial that closely. I don't know why it took that long, but yeah, as Cassie said, it's taken almost 10 years. I mean, the accounts from the children were quite grisly, and you know, and a lot of them have since grown up. I mean, one I think of the more emotional or more just detailed accounts came from a 26-year-old son who was, you know, just a teenager when all this was going on. You know, and they were forced to eat just vegetables. They could not get the food they wanted. They had to go to the bathroom in a bucket. And also in this area in Awanga, it's kind of rural, and there's apparently a lot of space between the homes. So no one really had any idea what was going on. I mean, they really had no next-door neighbors to speak of, and as Cassie said, it wasn't until one of the wives passed the note to someone at the one post office in the area that you know, law enforcement was able to start investigating and take some action.
The children didn't go to school?
Not that I know of.
Okay. David, What about you? What do we know about this family and its background and anything that might explain this?
Well, they've been itinerant family. They've lived in Hemet. They've lived in five or six locations around the Inland Empire. At one point, they were allegedly lived in a van for 2 years, 14 children, and while a guy, Muhammad, lived in a motel nearby, parked in a lot of a mosque. He kept them all locked up. I don't think they ever went to school. He kept them locked up in barns, with no toilets, just a mattress. One kid repeatedly broke bottles over his head so he can go be sent to the hospital and eat, and get free food and move around freely. That was how bad it was. They remind me of a lot of these cases we get out way out in the desert in some place like this, where these folks just go live where no one can see them and just create their own little kingdoms of horror, as what happened in this case.
Cassie, let me go back to you on this and on this issue of, and David just mentioned the kid went to the hospital a couple of times. Could this, you have a community where people are spread out and isolated, and that obviously contributes to this, but could any institution have seen this earlier and brought it to the attention of authorities earlier?
I don't know. I know hospitals are required to report if they believe that if there's child abuse, and prompt an investigation. It is puzzling why in this case that doesn't seem to have happened. I have not heard that there has been any investigation of the social service agencies. These cases are so tragic. I think they're, as David said, we've seen them before. There was one where two brothers were kept virtually caged for years and years until finally one of them was able to get a phone and call 911. And, they're isolated, they're remote from other families and locations, and no one knows what goes on in these little gated compounds.
Stephen, any last thoughts on this?
No, it's just that, I'm sure people in that area were certainly stunned and are relieved to see some resolution.
We are conducting our Inland Empire Journalist Roundtable with Cassie McDuff with the Press Enterprise, Stephen Cuevas, KPCC's Inland Empire reporter, and David Kelly, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Our next issue that we're discussing, the mayor of Ontario, Paul Lyon, has, after 2 weeks of not discussing it, has apologized for having an affair with a city-contracted employee. The allegations surfaced earlier this month that he has been having an affair with a married female employee at the Ontario Convention Center. Mayor Lyon is also married and is a pastor at Hope Chapel Church in Ontario. An attorney says the mayor and this employee would meet at a hotel suite or at the chapel for their affair, and the attorney also claims Lyon spent several thousand dollars of campaign funds on a personal trainer. Stephen, you're very familiar with the story. Take it from there.
Unfortunately familiar. It's a kind of a strange case. I mean, it came to light in a very odd way. This attorney, who has been hired by some clients who she will not disclose the names of, showed up at a city council meeting earlier this month. And when it came time for the public comment part of the meeting, she, made these allegations and brought up the affair and how the mayor misspent all this money. He was not there at the time. He was on vacation in Hawaii. When I asked the attorney, why didn't you wait until he was there? And, she claims, she didn't know he was on vacation, and she drove all the way from Los Angeles and, I guess, wanted to say her piece.
This is an attorney for the woman?
No, not that we know of. The woman who was having the affair with the mayor is still employed at the Ontario Convention Center, and actually made a public statement right after this news came to light and said that there was no impropriety between her and the mayor and that he's always treated her with respect and kindness. But she, at the time, did not admit to this affair. The mayor pretty much did admit to the affair at this council meeting this week, would not go into great detail about it, and accused whoever is behind this surveillance and the accusations as being, this whole thing is just being motivated by politics you know, but he didn't, and no one else in the city has said, well, who, you know, who would go after you in this manner? So that's where we are now, and right now the attorney is working with these clients who, I should say, you know, she describes them as kind of, you know, third party people who heard things from people who worked in the city who were concerned, saying that the mayor has had this problem before, that he's, you know, quote unquote, a predator, and that, you know, something needs to be done to stop him. But no one apparently who has actually been on the receiving end of this alleged harassment is among the clients that this lawyer says she has.
So that makes it kind of more interesting in that even if all of this is true, we don't know much about the person who exposed it.
Correct. The reason, according to the attorney, that no one is coming forward is that they're afraid of retaliation. So we'll just have to wait and see. She apparently has more information that she's going to share with everyone soon, but she would not really say one way or the other what that might be.
So what is the mayor now facing from the council and possibly he's, from prosecution?
Well, he's the city says or has not said whether or not it will conduct its own investigation to see if anything was going on, which I think is a little surprising. It's a little unusual. They may change their minds and actually investigate what went on. The mayor says he's going to hire a campaign finance consultant to audit his records to prove that he did nothing wrong, at least to his knowledge, he says. So he's basically going to investigate himself, is one way of looking at it. And he's an extremely popular guy, you know, throughout the region with the county supervisors, with other communities. He's, you know, been credited with really helping Ontario move forward economically. You know, so he has a lot of support in the community, and a lot of people turned out at this council meeting this week to throw their support behind him.
We are conducting our Inland Empire Journalist Roundtable with KPCC's Inland Empire reporter Stephen Cuevas, also Cassie McDuff from the Press Enterprise, and David Kelly, staff writer for the LA Times. Our next story, an inland car dealer was indicted this week along with three of his employees of laundering more than $50,000 in illegal campaign contributions to six Republican candidates. Mark Leggio of Upland is accused of having his employees make contributions to candidates he also contributed to, then reimbursing them, thus exceeding campaign contribution limits. David, why don't you take it from there?
Yeah, this case has been investigating this for a year and a half, and Leggio owns three car dealerships in San Bernardino and Riverside County, and he's a major Republican donor. He's given to lots of people over the years. And by the way, this case it looks like it's going to expand beyond just these six candidates locally, and probably go into other federal congressmen and Senate races as well. But you're allowed to give $3,600 per person, and so he would exceed this by he would give his $3,600, and then he would have employees give theirs, and then he'd pay them back. So he was able to give twice as much to each of these six political candidates. They finally tracked him down. They saw some suspicious donations going on. The Riverside County DA worked closely with the California Attorney General's office, and they finally indicted these guys. They unsealed the indictment last week in San Bernardino Superior Court, and they're going to have an arraignment next month. But Leggio is considered the ringleader. He's facing up to almost 7 years in prison. The other guys are his employees, who he gave the money to give to the other candidates. They face about 3 years. But this looks like it's going to expand beyond the Inland Empire into other races. I think the guys who do this sort of thing don't limit themselves to just local races. The biggest person who got the money was the Banning mayor, Brenda Salas. She received $15,000. None of these politicians are being accused of any wrongdoing at this time. According to the government, they didn't know the money was illegally given to them. but it's going to, you know, he has significant economic interests in all these areas. You know, some of the money he gave to, like, for example, a current Ontario city councilman got, you know, money, and he's got a car dealership we want to get in Upland. He's got a car dealership in Banning. There's serious reasons why he's given money out.
Besides those two figures, Cassie, who else are we talking about, and what's the political fallout?
Well, you know, the political fallout so far, the politicians are not accused of anything. So far, it looks like they are not considered to have known that this was going on. You know, the problem with this is a violation of the California Political Reform Act. The purpose of the act was so that there would be transparency, so voters could take a look at who is giving money to the candidates and figure out for themselves if these candidates are making choices based on being beholden to their contributors. So by concealing who the true source of the contributions is, that's where the violation comes in. Now, what's extraordinary here is that this could have been simply a civil fine imposed by the Fair Political Practices Commission, an administrative body that reviews these kinds of violations, but the Riverside DA launched a criminal probe, and the Attorney General joined it because the car dealer, of course, Mark Leggio, is based in San Bernardino County, so the case expanded from there. But he has been charged with felonies because he's a major donor, and by filing reports that didn't, according to the Attorney General, accurately reflect the contributions that were coming from him, he perjured himself. This is the allegation. And so that's why it escalates to a serious criminal case.
Stephen Cuevas, for the employer, Mark Leggio, and the three employees are all charged. Is there any evidence there was some coercion involved in which the employer coerced the employees? And,
you know, I'm wondering that too, because it's not clear that the relationship here, aside from being employees, and yeah, that's, you know, none of the defendants have talked yet, but it'd be interesting to see what comes out, and that was there any coercion going on, even if it was sort of passive. And if these guys were actually even of the same mind politically as their boss, or was it just kind of like the right thing to do to keep the boss happy? We just don't know yet, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this came about and what kind of real support was there from these other three defendants.
Okay, thank you so much. Stephen Cuevas, KPCC's Inland Empire reporter, David Kelly, staff writer for the LA Times, Cassie McDuff, columnist with the Press Enterprise. To be continued on all these stories in the Inland Empire. Coming up, we'll talk to author David Lakoff about his new book, The Political Mind: Are Progressives and Democrats Falling Short in Terms of Knowing How the Mind Works and How to Use That in Their Favor Against Conservatives, which Lakoff argues have been much more successful in using